Well, it's not clear because I find it hard to recall where Allport talks about ability at all. He certainly talks about both attitudes, values, and traits. And in terms of those, he would allow that, they can change over time. They're not immune. And if he had ability in his thing, presumably he would allow that those change. Be pretty rash not to.
Does he say, just talk about the traits and don't consider the individual moves after you've got them translated into traits?
No, he says, it's via this that you can analyze and exhibit what that move was.
And yet that's a question, can't.
And then he follows by saying, and when you do this, you find uniqueness in people, that no two people are alike. Whereas if you just talk about one like this, you'd be able to compare people in terms of the number, the extent to which strategy entered their behavior. But for this person, strategy is literally a different trait than strategy for somebody else, because it's embedded in a whole hierarchy that's a structure. See, this in effect is the psychic part of your neuropsychic structure, this hierarchy. And he says, no two people are alike in that structure, unique. And it's via this kind of analysis that you get at that uniqueness.
But you could only have the hierarchy in the form of
you don't know that. So you can't guarantee that any sample is going to give you the same as the other, but you certainly can't guarantee that it won't. And clearly, for practical purposes, if you've got a five-year chunk of somebody's life, you're not going to be that reluctant to extrapolate to now if it's been the last 5 years. Well, what about the adequacy of this description? Does it get at what you understand about chess? Certainly it gets at something about chess. And there's nothing illegitimate about this kind of description. And it's informative in certain ways.
What are the motivations for the behavior as a whole, rather than as moves, and motivations for each of the moves?
Well, you've got this cardinal trait that's going to extend essentially throughout the game.
But that doesn't satisfy me to explain why a person would sit down to a chessboard. I was saying that person has a need to make a checkmate. Doesn't satisfy the explanation for them.
You're going beyond the sample. The sample is a sample of chess playing behavior, and you're going beyond it to some time before and asking, how come this whole sequence occurred within this larger sequence?
Right.
That's like taking moves 3 to 10 and saying, how come this sequence occurred within this chess game? If you had the larger sample, you would have another cardinal trait or something else. And you'd still have the same points. For example, you might have the need for recreation. And playing chess is a form of recreation, and that's how come he starts playing chess. That might be one of his central, if not cardinal, traits. Well, right here. Yeah. Remember, when we diagrammed the trait, behavior corresponded to performance. This behavior, as referred to in the trait definition, corresponded to performance in intentional action.
If you were looking at that and looking at the right side,
well, we could put it in by hypothesizing further as to whether the strategy was successful, whether he did in fact control, etc. See, we could expand each of these in the way that we did the definition of the trait, and corresponding to each of these, plug in a K, W, and K, H set of values. See, the trait definition gives us at least that much, except that we would then have to once more transform it into an ID characteristic.
Even if I accept this as an adequate explanation for the behavior sample, I question what use is it beyond seeing uniqueness in individuals?
You can't do both. You can't both, in a blanket way, say it's adequate and then ask what good is it.
Not what good is it, but...
So you have to say, well, it's adequate for X, but is it good for Y? Because if it's just plain adequate, then it is good for Y.
That's what fine is.
Yeah. That's why I formulated the problem. Is it adequate to express your understanding of what goes on in chess? Now, you can try variations on that. Could you, by giving explanations of these sort, teach somebody what chess was? Could you, by giving these kinds of explanation, explain to somebody who didn't know about chess, explain what was going on there? Well, those would be sort of rule of thumb tests for, is this an adequate way of expressing what you know about chess?
You really couldn't teach the individual moves that each thing did either, could you?
Well, remember, this one is one of our behaviors, and you could have a whole list of those, except it would be a long list.
Seems that you could probably do a reasonable job teaching somebody who's like chess with this if they knew what the parameters were, maybe what was allowable.
But well, that, is there any way of saying what's allowed?
I don't think so. There's no way of saying what can a pawn do or what can a queen do.
Well, you can indirectly by having a list of pawn moves.
Okay. This is one of the possible pawn moves. Yeah. It gets a little weighty.
Yeah.
You can have each move as an expression of the trait following the proper rules of the game.
What rule? Well, at that point, I think you're verging on the homunculus explanation. He's playing chess because he's following the rules of playing chess, because he has a chess playing trait that is producing that behavior. He's making a chess move because that behavior is an expression of a chess-playing trait which is generating that behavior. So you have a chess-playing trait generating chess-playing behavior.
Well, don't you have to somehow account for the fact that he knows how to play chess as a trait?
Well, you would to express what you know about it. The question is, can you do it this way? See, I said, I don't know that Alport ever does talk about abilities as such. If he doesn't talk abilities as such, he wouldn't be able to talk about the ability to play chess. But again, remember, ability is an ID characteristic, and he's thinking mainly in terms of behavior.
But isn't it a case that person differs on skill or ability to play chess?
Yeah. It's clearly the case that we all know that people differ in their ability to play chess and that there are such things as abilities, and one ability is the ability to play chess. As I say, I don't know that Allport can talk about abilities.
But the traits that you show because you're skilled are different from the traits that somebody else would might show because he's not skilled, but if he was skilled, he would show.
Yeah.
Or if the teacher is not that skilled and doesn't have all these strategies as traits.
Yeah.
The person's always learning, he's learning their patience and teaching
them. Yeah, you would have traits expressed, or abilities expressed indirectly, in that the traits that you acquire will somehow be in conformity with your abilities. But that's a poor way of getting access to abilities, isn't it? In fact, you already have to know they're there in order to see them here.
couldn't you tie that to the definition of playing chess? In that somebody who's playing chess, you have to assume that person knows how all the different pieces move. You assume he has that ability.
That's people who sit down to play life must
know.
That's
probably what Alpert said, right?
No.
Why not?
He doesn't.
Oh.
Also, when would?
Did you know I played chess the first time you sat down?
No, but I wasn't playing chess then. Okay. When I sat down to figure out where the pawn could go, I wasn't playing chess. I was learning how to play chess. Which is different. You're talking about a chess game here, so, and you assume that somebody who plays chess, they have already done that for something. Mm-hmm. Maybe developmental ability.
You're raising the question of whether this is an adequate description of chess. Was that Alport's concern?
Yes.
Or so, the behavior of individuals, you know, but always bothering me about this is where does PQ3, where is its locus in a sense? If the person doesn't know about chess, or the describer doesn't know about chess.
You will not find any theory dealing with those issues. Those are dealt with in methodology at most.
But Alport wouldn't have been concerned about whether this was an adequate representation of.
That's right. That was his concern.
Chess.
Not of chess, of the behavior.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. If you're saying the consistency is not adequate, I think that's what you're saying. The consistency.
I'm trying hard not to.
But the consistency you're saying is it responding to some kinds of consistency and not other kinds.
Well, I'm saying specifically, is it responsive to what we know
about chess
is going on there? Yeah.
But in some
you might not even want to call it consistency.
Yeah, I would.
See, Alport put it in terms of consistency, and it's a fairly colloquial way of putting it, in that people kind of know what you mean when you say, "Well, people's behavior is consistent." So it wasn't as though he was making it up.
That somehow doesn't sound like the same question to me as, "What do we know about chess?" Or is it a description of chess?
Well, you can break it down into both. Is this a way of exhibiting or analyzing or explaining the consistency that we know exists in chess games? Secondly, does it do justice to what we understand about playing chess?
I'm not sure why is you trying to get some explanation of the game of chess out of the behavior description.
Well, I didn't ask about chess. I'm talking about what we know about playing chess. Playing chess is behavior. And it would be hard to claim that you understood that behavior if you didn't somehow connect it to the game of chess.
Doesn't the potential action is
know-how, it's the comparable one. They're both competence concepts, but it's a very different notion.
If that's the case, then because the traits could be described in terms of those K, W, and K, then that would inherently include the ability aspect.
No. Know-how is a parameter of behavior, and ID is a different parameter, and ability is one of the ID notions. Know-how is the other competence notion.
So
and having the know-how will not get you the ability.
So the ID characteristics, so because traits are ID characteristics, they have to have the parameters specified as relevant to ID characteristics,
yeah,
rather than relevant to behavior. So that's why it's lacking in that aspect.
Yeah, that's why even if you translated these into behavior for the sake of the trait, you still wouldn't have the notion of ability.
One other ID characteristics are there.
Well, Alport talks about traits, attitudes, and values. And sometimes he talks about expressive behavior, which is pretty much equivalent to style. So of our four dispositions, trait, attitude, style, what he's missing is interest. And then he has one of what for us is a power concept, namely value.
So you feel that it's inadequate to the extent that he's missing the
Well, yeah. If those other ID characteristics are essential here, then it's missing at least that much.
So to that extent, you know.
Yeah. But that's not the main place where you ought to be finding something fishy here. Yeah. See, that's what you might call a technical difficulty, in that he just wasn't complete enough in what he did. Try thinking in terms of, in principle, just this form of description.
How can you generate the list?
By observation.
But how would you know
what
you're watching? Yeah,
you can
see the Q3, but how would you know what it was?
Well, remember, Allport's hierarchy is content free, and he allows you to put in anything you want there.
Well,
you're back to Jerry's question that as an observer, if you were doing this reconstructing, you indeed would have to know something in order to give these descriptions.
But that's so it's still, I see it as a different problem from playing the game, but I don't see it. They're still preceding both of those things.
See, what you might say is that since it's content free, in many respects, it's illuminating, because you got to do all of this on your own before you can plug the stuff into the content-free hierarchy. And in that sense, you would say it's unilluminating. It's not that it's wrong, but there's a lot of important things that you have to do by yourself independently of the theory, and that you would need in order to use the theory.
But also in the knowing of the game.
Yeah.
What keeps on bugging me is this list of traits or whatever.
But that's what you're committed to with this approach.
Okay, in this example, would you have a list of all possible traits, or that is...
Well, here we got what we take to be relevant ones.
All possible relevant traits that we could... Okay.
And then we have this for expressing for a given behavior which of them were, in fact, relevant.
It just seems that...
And that shows up in this example.
Say you have strategy X. You also have strategy Y, Z, etc., which...
And
it seems that there's no generative notion.
No, but if you look at the first 10 moves, you can pretty well be able to spot whether he's following strategy X or strategy Y.
But there's no knowledge of strategy Y in play. You're saying he knows only what he's expressing.
No, you're not saying what he knows. You're saying what he's doing. And by the way, these are intended to be variables. When I say strategy X, X means some number of strategies, and capture X means capture some number of different things, etc.
There's no notion of all strategies possible.
Well, it depends on what you want to include. I say you're free to include anything you want, including all possible strategies, if you can manage the notion of all possible strategies. Normally, you have a list of distinct strategies that you distinguish, and then you plug it in.
How does one account for the different descriptions of the traits from different
descriptions of traits?
Pardon?
What different descriptions of traits?
Two people look at that move on Queen 3 and come up with different strengths and different traits.
Well, you pretty well have to look at a number of behaviors before coming back to this one and saying what trait is exhibited. But even so, suppose you looked at all 32 moves. You're right, different people would give different descriptions, and Allport says it. Except he says it kind of as a technical problem that when it comes to frequency, Different people will require different frequencies in order to say that there's a trait of that sort there. And that looks like merely a technical problem there. But recognize that, in fact, different people would probably assign some different strategies, et cetera, as well as different numbers. And the most you can say is Alport says, well, yeah, that's likely to happen. But again, it's not systematized. It's simply that there's nothing in what he does say that precludes things like that happening. Most you can say is, well, if it happens, you know, that may make some descriptions impractical. Or if you had to have a system where everybody agreed, this approach might be impractical because, in fact, maybe most people would disagree. That's a practical and not a theoretical question.
Isn't that what we're after?
No, we're after in principle. If you use this approach, will it do for you what you would want done? Namely, express what you understand as being important and essential about that behavior there.
How about deliberate action and choice? Is there any way in which choice?
Well, again, the other part of the theory, the appropriate functions, would enable him to say that, yeah, the things that were done reflect the person's choices. But that's not connected systematically to this form of description. Is it in some other part of his theory, he says, yeah, that does happen.
And then the traits, the weight, the strength of the traits are the chooser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the strength of the traits reflects the choices he's made. That these two things work together like a warp and woof on a tapestry.
In the hierarchy, is it the frequency times the value, meaning the 9 and 7 that determines?
He talks about frequency mainly, but it's hard to see since he also, in individual cases, talks about the different contributions.
Yeah.
It's hard to see how you could avoid taking the number into account as well as the frequency.
My statement is...
If you want to be conservative, stay with the frequency, because that's what he clearly and explicitly says.
I think the outcome determines the ability. I mean, in this particular...
Yeah, you draw conclusions about ability from the outcome.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying, where in the theory is the ability shown? It's the outcome of the behavior.
No. Ability is not one of the systematic terms.
No, but it doesn't have a good...
It doesn't prevent you from talking about abilities, but neither does it enable you to. Again, it's something you have to do on your own, independently of the theory.
What seems to me to be a problem is the... combination, the interrelationship of traits.
In these?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I said that. I put a plus here, but really, there's a question.
Yeah, that's
and you would probably want to say and.
Even if you said and, that still seems rather inconclusive.
Yeah, you want and because it's ambiguous, and you don't really know what the connection is. That's why you want an ambiguous term.
If that's the case, then you don't really... Then you might say those weighted contributions to the behavior would require more in the sense that they should be vectored sort of.
The most you can say is that this might be incomplete because there's not an explanation within the theory as it now stands of what that connection or relationship is. But saying that it's incomplete that way is not to say that using these would be an inadequate way of accounting for that behavior.
Pete, what's your...
Well, look, I'm saying it's a simple problem. You're making it hard. Look at what you know about chess and compare it with this kind of thing.
Look, I didn't see the cow in that car.
You weren't supposed to. Compare it with this kind of account of what's going on. See, to begin with, you do get a chance to put in your rules right there. Secondly, you get a chance to talk about the sequence. And via the individual, the attributional and co-occurrence constraints, you can talk about strategies and other kinds of individual differences in playing here. You can also talk about choice, namely the choosing of options within the practice. You can talk about which practice it is. You've represented the sequential character of that particular practice. You've defined roles, you know, white, black, etc., via that portion. And you're also able, via a paradigm case approach, to say it's completely consistent. Every single move follows those rules. There's no issue of a focal quality or to some degree this and to some degree that. Every one of those moves follows that rule. Every one of those moves consists of participation in this practice. As I say, paradigmatically, because if somebody makes a false move, you count that as a failure. And you have the representation of the practice as your baseline for what it is a failure at. And via some strategies, etc., you can talk about what he intends, you can talk about it as deliberate action, etc.
You can't talk about eligibility.
Sure. The players have to be people. And the pieces are eligible to move certain ways and not others. They're eligible to capture in certain ways and not others.
This, another way of saying this difference between two approaches, each place and behavior in this context?
No, I don't think so, because in both cases, you're talking about this two-hour stretch during which they were playing chess. It's not a matter of adding more context. You can think of adding more context in the sense that as a form of behavior, this is repeatable, is inherently repeatable. And if it's a social practice, it is practiced. In that sense, you're implying other things going on elsewhere in that fairly non-committal way. That's different from extending this to the entire morning, say. Put it differently, you can get at the structural characteristics of the game this way, and you can't do it this way because you've imposed a structure, namely the hierarchical structure. And the structure of the game is essential to understanding it. That's why if all you could tell somebody was this kind of thing, he'd never understand what chess was all about. of the structure. So you can describe the elements pretty well in these terms, particularly if you allow yourself that kind of. But the fact that chess has a certain structure given by contingencies and eligibilities, that kind of thing, how would you represent it in this kind of framework?
You just have to get it by full explication of lists.
Well, even if you had a list here, how would you express the fact that these are the only legal moves?
Well, because you could never specify. All you'd be getting, I guess, were the behaviors that occurred during a specific game.
Well, but one of the behaviors.
You could say this is a full range.
Now, one of the behaviors could be an illegal move. You can make illegal moves in chess, except that if you do, you're not playing chess. But how would you represent that here? As I said, over there, you use a paired and case formulation.
Trade of cheating.
Trade of failing.
Trade of failing. That's a stretch. Admittedly, it's stretching it, but it seems that you could eventually, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is.
Get to some sort of representation, although very clumsily.
Yeah.
And that's an inadequacy that's clumsy.
Well, how would you get at the structure of the game? Could you really do it this way, no matter how clumsily?
I guess that doesn't place any limits, so that there's no way of really saying these are all of the possible moves. You could just say these are moves.
At best, it would have to be extraordinarily cumbersome, so cumbersome as to be misleading, because there is a simple structure that you can get at, and doing it this way. See, would be like representing what's in this room by drawing a line from here to that corner and then projecting everything on it and then trying to decode it. And you could if you knew exactly what the room was like, but not otherwise.
Why would it be proper to say that that behavior, P to Q3, was an expression of the trait of playing a game with this structure?
What structure?
Well, with the structure where you could then list.
Well, but then you have to go to this to get the structure or something equivalent. And again, you're back to all of the hard work is done outside the theory.
Isn't that what you're really reaching those traits then?
Yeah. At this point, you come back to this and say, yeah, it's a certain kind of advantage in the theory that it allows you to put in any trait you want. On the other hand, in certain respects, it's a disadvantage in that it doesn't tell you anything about any traits. You already have to know about them in order to plug them into that formula. But compare that hierarchy to this. Doesn't the same thing hold there? Having a cause-effect formula doesn't tell you which things are causes and which things are effects, or which are causes of which. Simply allows you to plug in things that you know about independently into one or another of these positions. In that sense, it's uninformative. And in that sense, the hierarchy is uninformative because it has no content. Now, the social practice description has no content.
Would a computer program is good for a chess game? Aren't all those parameters necessarily included?
Chess programs are written in all kinds of funny ways. What has to be included is this kind of thing. As they have to make legal moves, beyond that, they're on their own.
But they have certain flow patterns and contingencies that they move through. Some are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
But only the end result, the printout, would be the.
Right. Yeah, they do indeed do things of this sort. They don't have to do it systematically, and they don't have to do those. They don't have to have the kind of contingencies that you would have in playing chess. All they have to do is have contingencies that can be implemented by the computer and that result in legal moves, and hopefully that win.
There was a national computer chess
game. Yeah.
It's kind of equipment. The concept of district design isn't a theory because it's not specifying content at that point. It's only specifying what is structured. And one of the things you say in the Alport's theory doesn't even mention is the structure, right? Okay.
No, it has a structure, but it's a peculiar one. It's a hierarchy. There are very few things in life that have that structure. 20 questions is about the only thing I can think of.
I understand the part of it. how much is this theory that that's specifying?
Well, that's a good question. How about everybody asking himself that? How much is a theory supposed to specify? What do you want out of a theory? What's it supposed to be doing for you? Because look, you can call this a theory if you want. Well, remember we said one of the things a theory gives you, whether it's empirical or not, is it gives you a set of formulations. It gives you a way of representing things. It introduces some kind of ordering into things. We also said a theory may not be useful if it introduces the wrong kind of ordering. And in effect, here we say a hierarchy doesn't look like the right kind of ordering for formulating what goes on in a chess game. Because there's a lot of things about a chess game that, you know, at best, you would have a monstrosity to try to represent that way. In contrast, here you have a content-free thing, but which has the kind of structure that fits and has enough flexibility so that you can tailor it to exactly what you want to represent. And when you do that, the fact that it's content-free becomes trivial. Whereas over here, you've got to do a hell of a lot of work in describing and representing before you've got something to plug in.
To me, that Alport wasn't trying to specify the game. He was trying to specify how people play. And while, yeah, we need...
Well, but look, is this a picture of how people play chess? That they are somehow combining strategy and control and offensiveness and aggressiveness and need to... Checkmate? If ever there was a violation of Maxim 1, that's it. You ask a person what is he doing when he's playing chess, his answer will not look anything like that.
Well, depending on how he understands your question. I mean, if we ask him about strategy.
Just ask him. And don't worry about what he understands. Just assume he understands what he's doing when he's playing chess. And he won't give you an answer that looks like this. And he will give you an answer that looks like some of the elements of this.
What? It sounds like you get two different questions going. One is the strategy, say the strategy that he was using.
But remember, the strategy is part of the description of his behavior. He did this because he was following the strategy. By doing this, he was implementing the strategy. It's part of what he was doing, and he'll tell you that. He'll tell you, I was playing a Jaco piano opening, and that's why I made this move. And he will not say anything that even remotely resembles this.
But what he's saying that he doesn't say to
you? Yeah.
What did he say?
I was playing a Jaco piano opening. What you do is you formulate a Jaco piano opening here as a sequence with contingencies and options. He's telling you that that's the form of behavior that he was engaged in. You can represent that here. You can distinguish a Jaco piano opening from a Ruy Lopez or other openings with that form of representation.
But are you saying the same thing here you can say in terms of, well, the most important thing was, well, I look at it, my priority was having this certain kind of opening, and at the same time, I also want to control this part of the board and kind of try to play an offense type game, and I want to get rechecked. What's the difference between that and the process description? I don't know.
Precisely that difference. That's a process description, and this isn't.
No, Pete, it seems that like this other thing, this is using one set of terms.
No, this is a process description, this is not a process description, and that's a fundamental difference when you're describing a process.
I'm making a bad assumption about this system, which I shouldn't.
No, look, you can use over here in terms of that judgment diagram are the priorities that guided the choices. But the priorities are not an account of the behavior. That's just an account of the priorities. You ask what was the behavior that those priorities were used to choose among, you need this kind of representation. That's why these lent themselves very well to being represented as reasons.
I'm just wondering whether the options in this case are just the, all other possible combinations.
No, you still have things that operate as reasons, and you do not have a process structure here.
If you list B1, B2, B3, or whatever, each one of these having is...
Well, at most, what you have is a version. You still don't have the process structure. You don't have a representation of what it is that's being exemplified here, therefore, of what it is that's being done, except under a performance description, namely, which sequence of moves. Also, keep in mind that with a hierarchy, you can't represent that sequence. You can count cases within the sequence, but you can't represent the sequence. So as I say, when it comes to describing processes, the difference between a process format and a non-process format is crucial. You can't describe a process with a object format, which is what a hierarchy is. That's a structure, not a process. So it gives you access to some of the facts about the process, but not some of the essentials, namely the process structure. And recall what I said about the problem with instinct theories before Freud, that there was too much of a one-to-one relation between the instinct and the behavior. If you behave aggressively, it's because you have an aggressive instinct, and that explains your aggressive behavior. Well, look at these things. They have a very similar feature. The only way you tell what kind of traits he has is because he does those behaviors. And that, too, does something for the illumination value of this way of doing it. If you have to decide that way about what the traits are because you already know what the behaviors are, and then you're going to explain the occurrence of the behaviors by reference to just those traits, how much have you gotten out of going through that whole procedure? Well, you've got something. For most purposes, I don't think you'd be happy with how much you got out of it. Keep in mind for future reference the issue of content-free formulations and what makes the difference between there being illuminating, adequate, helpful, useful, versus they're not being these. And one of the parameters there is how much work do you have to do independently of it in order to use it? The answer to that may range from nothing but things that are relatively trivial to you have to do 99% of it outside the formulation. For example, this, I'd say you have to do 99% of it outside the formulation. Whereas this, I would suggest the task that's left over after you exploit the formulation is as near trivial as you get with anything.
How would you describe the way in which we were making it difficult by not, bringing to bear the knowledge that chess is a process, behavior is a process?
Yeah. So you're getting too fancy and worrying about the technical difficulties. Whereas the fundamental thing is that this is a static representation and chess is a process. And they're not just completely isolated, and this kind of static representation is not just irrelevant. It's that it doesn't do it justice.
And will that kind of difficulty probably crop up with darn near every one of these spheres?
No, it didn't with psychoanalytic theory. Well, there we had process from the very beginning. We had instinct as a process. We had a sequence built into the most fundamental notion. And we had the process in the developmental sequence. We had the stages, the sequence, and the contingencies of the effects of one earlier on later.
But that fits in. We also said that Freudian psychoanalyst beliefs are considered the physiology of the thing anyway.
Yeah.
So this kind of structure might have been in the classical structure.
Yeah, well, even that hypothetical structure was doing a job because you had to show, you had to have something, even a hypothetical something that could be activated or non-activated. It takes a structure to do that. So it's not the case that with these theories you always find this kind of difficulty. Given that we're talking in terms of the difference between process and non-process, we can go back and do some more amateur diagnosis here on the difference between Freud and Alport. Remember, I said one of the things that Alport objected to was Freud's determinism. And we saw how in the reconstruction of that developmental sequence, because you have logical relations going backward, that same set of relations looks awfully attractive as a deterministic set of causal relations going forward. Now, because of this, practically every theory that talks about process explicitly is going to be a deterministic theory. And since Alport is refusing determinism, you might say it probably wasn't accidental that he also did not have a strong emphasis on process, that he didn't have a unified process representation of behavior and development. Because had he had it, the temptation would have been overwhelming to look at it and say, that's what operates deterministically through time to produce behavior as we see it. See, once you have a process and structure representation, the overwhelming temptation is to see it like machinery. And the paradigm of machinery is a deterministic functioning. Once you turn the switch, it's a mechanism. So if you're giving up mechanism and determinism, one of your possible devices is to give up process, or at least to give up unified process representation. Now, we're going to see later on that you don't have to, because the existentialists have managed to have process without determinism, but then the cost of that is going to show up in the peculiar kind of process it is.
Can you talk more about that
now? No, we'll get to that in two shots. See, our next one will be operant conditioning and then existentialism. Levine will be an option depending on how, what we have left over.
Let me be clear about that. A process representation need not be a deterministic representation, right? Like that.
Yeah.
The temptation historically has been there.
Yeah, not only historically, but currently. There are very few theorists who will give you a process representation and not think of it as a deterministic one.
Am I correct in understanding that one of the major ways of getting the process description of what non-deterministic is when we talk about options? Does that still want to get away from it?
Yeah, but if you only talk about options, you've lost the process.
Oh, I mean as well as the event.
No, that's one way of getting more complexity. But if you write deterministic contingencies, you can have all the options in the world and it's still deterministic.
What is the key then to talking about process without being deterministic? It's talking, saying, look, you can reconstruct the process.
The key is simply to see that you don't have to. There never was any real reason to.
Well, to be clear about knowing you're reconstructing rather than...
Okay, that's part of it. The formal device is that this is an observer's reconstruction. And it in no way implies that the reconstruction of the sequence, etc., is a causal sequence that way. And even if it is reconstructed by an observer as a causal sequence, you have individual differences as to which observers reconstructed which way. So there's nothing in the formulation that either prevents you from giving a causal process description or that forces you to do it. And it's not an arbitrary thing. You have the individual difference notion to explain the difference as to how come one person does it one way and another does it the other. So even the selection of those is non-arbitrary. So that's an example of the fact that even though it's content-free, it gives you access to all of those possibilities. Okay, I think that's as much as we want to do with that part of Allport. There's another part having to do with the whole notion of self that's also historically important. Partly because Allport was one of the earliest people, at least in American psychology, to talk about the self. Now here again we need a little bit of history. American psychology, I think particularly, although I can say psychology generally, was the form of its theorizing was a reaction against philosophical and theological theorizing, in which notions of soul and spirit were very prominent. Less formally, there were the notions of the inner man and the outer man. And the inner voice and the outer voice. See, there was a certain kind of language, a certain set of concepts in philosophy and theology, which psychologists were very concerned to disassociate themselves from. Now, it happens that the term self is practically the equivalent of soul or spirit.
A question first, and that is, why was there such a strong need to get away from those terms?
Because you can't run causal processes on souls or spirits. And souls or spirits are not operationalizable and they're not observable. How can you do science with things like that? Now, in particular, there was one bugaboo called the homunculus explanation, and that's the inner man, outer man. It's very easy to say, well, the outer man does what he does because there's an inner man who does what he does. And then allow the inner man to be a soul or a spirit. Now, it turns out that there's nothing wrong with talking that way. If you look at it in a purely formal way, talking about soul or spirit is like Freud talking about the psychic object. It is a way of introducing a fundamental psychological concept into a system from which you derive all other psychological facts. And if you're going to talk about people, you need at least one such notion. Everything else can be physiological, physical, or whatever, but unless you have at least one fundamental psychological notion, you're not talking about people. So in theology and philosophy, soul or spirit defined that range of facts. Formally, that's what those notions did. So it's not that there's anything per se wrong with doing it. That's why I say you have to go to history to say, well, then how come psychologists were so uptight about it? And the answer is they wanted to distinguish their enterprise as a scientific enterprise from what these other people were doing and had been doing for the last 2,000 years. One of the major ways you distinguish what you're doing from what other people are doing are that you talk differently. That's an immediate signal. It's a self-presentation that says, I'm doing psychology, not philosophy. Now, as I said, you need a psychological notion, and self was sufficiently uncontaminated so that psychologists were tempted to use it, and they did, at least informally. But when it came to putting it in a theory, it also had too much of the connotation of soul or spirit. So here Alport talks about self, and then he has to clean up his act. What he has to do is to deny that the self is an immaterial thing, or that it's an inner person. And he certainly doesn't want to identify the self with a material thing, that is, with physiology. Should say with a merely material thing. So what's left? Well, we already saw a precedent with Freud when he talked about id, ego, superego, and then said, keep in mind, folks, when I say id, ego, and superego, I mean id functioning, ego functioning, and superego functioning. And that's a way of transforming it from an apparent object to a process, a way of functioning. And this is what Alport did. When he finally got around to dealing with the issue of self, he made it into a bundle of several forms of functioning. And just as with Freud, you could say, well, when the person is being realistic, that's an instance of ego functioning or secondary process. Alport would say, well, when the person is doing such and such, or where the personality is doing such and such, that's an example of appropriate functioning. Now, if you turn in your books to the right page, you have a description of what's included under the self or appropriate functioning. And it's on page 268. Just appropriate. By the way, if you're a bug on etymology, you'll recognize that appropriate is simply a translation of self.
Appropriate.
It's a Latin version of self. Proprium. Okay, so here's the self or ego functionings. Namely, bodily sense, self-identity, self-esteem, self-extension, sense of selfhood, rational thinking, self-image, appropriate striving, cognitive style, and the function of knowing. Well, as I said, think of this as a way of getting the distinctively psychological aspects of people into the picture. There's also an excursion into phenomenology. They have in common a phenomenal warmth and a sense of importance. This I would suggest you forget about. It belongs to an earlier phase of psychological theorizing, which is best exemplified by, I think, William James, who introspected on the concept of himself and concluded that the self was a feeling of tightness around your throat. Because that's the experience he had when he thought of himself. And saying that these things are characterized by phenomenal warmth and importance is a move of the same sort, and it adds nothing to the theory. It may not detract anything, but it's a peculiar kind of move which has a historical place, but I don't think anybody would do that sort of thing now. Now, again, the fact that there are not tight connections between different parts of the theory gives Allport the flexibility to use the various portions in various ways, since they don't conflict with one another, since they're not connected with one another. So he's able to take this notion of self and the appropriate functions to give access to, as I say, the distinctive things that people do. The fact that they make decisions, have purposes, have intentions, act deliberately, know what they're doing, and the various things that follow from that can be derived if you, again, go back to the text and to those specific appropriate functions. You can see that if you allow yourself to talk that way, you'll be able to talk about these distinctively human things. Now, the major connections of the self or appropriate functions to other parts of the system are a way of explaining longitudinal development. Is a way of explaining, for example, why certain instances of functional autonomy are important and how come they come about. Of emphasizing the difference between functional autonomy, which is mere perseveration, versus what he would call genuine or growth functional autonomy. He uses it to account for consistency over long periods of time in a person's history. The person's appropriate strivings are long-range, important, central strivings. Therefore, they're the kind that you might expect to have an influence on his behavior over long periods of time as against moment to moment. The The net result then is that he's able to give the what the long-term, large-scale picture of people in distinctively human terms, without denying that the short-term conditioning type things, reinforcement type things, etc., have an effect. He says, sure, people learn things, and sure, I wouldn't doubt but what they learn them in the way that learning theorists do. However, the patterning of a person's life, the patterning of his personality, isn't just a matter of being conditioned. Why? Because the appropriate structure, the self-structure, has an influence, and it is what provides the cross-sectional and long-term unity.
Not saying this is how appropriate functions are related to conditioning, etc. He just says that they're both related in a person's life.
Mm-hmm. Again, another example of if you don't connect things, you can use each of them freely whenever you want to. You don't put constraints on how they're used. Now, the last thing is that appropriate strivings or appropriate functions connect to a paradigm of self-actualization or maturity. And somewhere there is a short characterization on page 277. Characterization of the mature person. Mature personality. You see, the first one is an extension of the self. And the explanation is his life must not be tied narrowly to a set of activities that are closely linked to his own immediate needs and duties. Now, that should sound familiar to you from Maxim 4 and the corresponding part of psychoanalytic theory. That anybody who is just out after what he wants right now is not what we normally would call mature. We would say he lacks impulse control, lacks integration, etc. So here we find the same notion showing up in Allport's definition of a mature individual. Now, for maturity, the individual must also be able to relate himself warmly to others. Possess a fundamental emotional security and an acceptance of himself. Should be realistically oriented to himself and with respect to outer reality. Consider the connection between that and ego functioning in Freud's theory. And the components of realistic are insight and humor. And the one of interest there is humor. Very few theorists have brought in humor as part of the theory. Freud did a lot of work on explaining humor, but it wasn't part of his basic theory. Whereas for Allport, it's one of the marks of a mature individual. And you might ask yourself, how come? What is it about humor that could give it that kind of stature? And then keep in mind that it's presented under the notion of realistic orientation. And that, too, is a little paradoxical, isn't it? Don't generally think of humor as realistic. You tend to assimilate it to fantasy, to unreality, rather than reality, don't you?
With absurdity.
Yeah, absurdity, yeah. Well, yet to discover an absurd reality. As a lot of humor depends on paradox or other things that simply are not straightforward being realistic. So you might do a little brooding about how come for all four, at least humor had this basic status. Remember, this comes under the heading of being realistic.
But that's realistic, and that wasn't.
Why is it realistic? Does it mean that everybody is laughable?
And that should be true.
Why? See, it's one thing to say it, and another thing to make a case for it. It's true that I think we probably have a lot of agreement in saying that somebody who had no sense of humor wasn't as mature as he could be. But I think that it's not an easy job to explain why humor is both fundamental and a part of being realistic. Because, for example, we would also say a guy with no imagination isn't as mature as he could be. We certainly wouldn't assimilate imagination with being realistic. So just the fact that it is one of the things that you need to have to be mature doesn't make it part of a reality orientation.
It seems funny by default, part of the context of what's going on and what you'd be missing. If you couldn't see the humor in something, you're missing maybe part of the reality, or you just look at it.
Well, what is the reality that corresponds to humor?
It's realistic that if you take yourself too seriously, that could be pathogenic.
Yeah. Well, all I want to do is remind you that the connection between humor and being realistic is not simple and direct. Okay, now the final one is a unifying philosophy of life. And here we come back to the unity theme. And a unifying philosophy of life is your largest unity notion. It's the one that has the largest scope. So if you put all of these things together, one of the central features of Allport's notion of the self is its unifying function. It is by reference to the self that you can and do formulate most of the kinds of unity that you find in people. And then a reminder that there's not that close a connection between unity tapped this way, namely by reference to the self, and unity tapped via the hierarchy of traits.
There's not
that close a connection. What you can say is that the unity in the hierarchy of traits develops over time, partly as a result of the influence of appropriate functions. And that conversely, it exercises an influence on the later operation of appropriate functions. Okay, so unity, uniqueness, genuine choice, genuine growth are the kinds of things that Allport's theory is designed to preserve at whatever cost. And I think our examination has shown that the major cost is in the degree to which the thing is systematic, the degree to which it's interconnected, the degree to which he has process descriptions. It's not really a process description, it's the name of a hypothetical process. It's like secondary process and primary process. See, as a process description, you still have all of the task of representing whatever processes you would want to call appropriate function. At least it gives you a name and a process concept. You know, next time, we should be able to deal with any remaining questions, if there are any, about Allport, and begin on the operant conditioning theory. By the way, turn in the exercises on Alport.
And these are on Freud.
Oh, turn in the one on Freud, but also the one on the chess example for Alport.
Is that an assignment?
I thought I assigned you to.
No.
All right, turn in the one on Freud. Also, since we have essentially finished with Alport, do the parallel exercise on Fritz and Gloria using Alport's theory.